today. This is a joint brown bag with the Africa Biodiversity Collaborative Group and the Nature Conservancy. I'll talk about the ABCG component to this, and then my colleague Kristen Patterson will introduce our illustrious top expert, Dr. Elizabeth Gray. For those of you who may not be aware, the Africa Biodiversity Collaborative Group is a project of seven international conservation organizations working together to address emerging and high-priority issues affecting biodiversity in Africa. We receive funding from our member organizations, which include African Wildlife Foundation, Conservation International, the Jane Goodall Institute, the Nature Conservancy, Wildlife Conservation Society, World Resources Institute, and World Wildlife Fund U.S. In addition, we also receive a healthy amount of support from USAID's Africa Bureau, specifically their biodiversity analysis and technical support program. FAT supports us in a great many things that we do, including this work on adaptation that Elizabeth will present CNC's portion of. But I also wanted to mention to you how this fits in, how today's talk fits into the overarching work that ABCG members are doing independently and together on climate change adaptation. One of our tasks within the VAT funding is climate change generally, and one of those subtasks is on adaptation. We last year did a review of ABCG members' approaches to adaptation and produced this report, which came out last year, a nice little launch event at USAID. There are a great many resources available, including full text of the report, as well as this very easy to digest two-pager on the ABCG website, which is abcg.org. And I'll pass this around for anyone that would like to see it, but please note that that is a desk copy and not for distribution. We do have additional copies of the two-pager on the table here, and if they all get taken before you get a chance to have one, feel free to see our website for more. We've emerged from the past 2 days of discussions on what next. How do we take the information that we've developed thus far on the approaches that ABCG members are taking to adaptation and share that with a broader community? Some of the overarching lessons that we want to share are that collaborations are very valuable when approaching climate change, particularly in approaching adaptation. In looking at the group analysis, we saw a number of patterns that we wouldn't have seen if we looked at just a organization by organization basis. We work with data limitations. There are great amounts of data that we don't know, and in some cases we don't know what we don't know. So continuing to work together is helping to reveal some of those limitations and the patterns. And finally, climate change adaptation requires comprehensive engagement with people and communities. And Elizabeth's talk will get to that point very well. So with that, I would also like to ask you all to sign in. Let us know that you're here today. You don't have to sign in. There's a column at the end where you can place a check mark if you'd like to be added to our listserv, which sends out information about events like this one, as well as new publications, resources, job opportunities, training opportunities. So if you're interested in that, please check the box. We'll add you. If you're not interested, then please go ahead and sign in anyway, but you don't have to check that box. So with that, I'll turn it over to Kristen Patterson from TNC.
So welcome, everyone. Thanks for making the time to hear about our climate work in Tanzania today. And I'm Kristen Patterson. I manage our relationships with external funding agencies here in the DC area for TNC's Africa region. And Elizabeth is kind to come here after spending about 3 weeks in Tanzania, being home in Seattle for 36 hours, and then returning to DC. So we're lucky to have her here today. And Elizabeth has worked for TNC for over 10 years now, 12 years, and halfway to that chair, 25, right? And she has worked in conservation for the past 20 years, managing high-performance teams in biological sciences and facilitating strategic planning. And she's worked on projects all over the world, and for the past 2 years has been working with the Africa region on our climate change work in Western Tanzania. She has her PhD in ecology from the University of Washington and her undergrad from Harvard. So with that, welcome. I think we'll get started, and I think what will work best is for Elizabeth to give the talk, and then there'll be plenty of time afterwards for questions and answers. And we're planning on ending at 1:30. If you have to leave beforehand, please exit really quietly.
And for those who are joining us remotely, and we have about 10 people online and on the phone right now, if you could please mute your phones, just in case of any background sounds. And when it comes to the Q&A period, you can use the drop-down menu. If you put your mouse at the top of the screen, you'll see a little button that says chat, and you can click that and type in your questions, and I will relay them to Elizabeth.
So, good afternoon. Thanks again for taking the time to come hear about our work in Western Tanzania. So today what I'm going to be talking about is a project that the Nature Conservancy has been doing in collaboration with other conservation organizations in Tanzania, the Jane Goodall Institute, the Frankfurt Zoological Society, as well as the Tanzania National Park Authority and local government officials. And what we've been doing is, first of all, trying to figure out how climate has been and is likely to continue to change in Western Tanzania, and then secondly and more importantly, to figure out how to best adapt to this changing future. And so just kind of on a personal note, before I started working on climate change in Tanzania, so I've been doing climate change work in the U.S. for a number of years now, I really found climate change work pretty challenging. A lot of the rhetoric is a lot of doom and gloom, as I'm sure you all are familiar with, and there's really polarized views about what's going to happen in the future and, more importantly, what we should do about it. But working in Tanzania, for me, has been really refreshing, and that's because I find that in Tanzania, people are really hungry for more information, and they also want to know what can we do now to deal with the changes that we're already seeing here. And so I think this is an excellent opportunity to take advantage of this momentum and to really work together in partnership with other organizations to try to develop climate adaptation strategies that are both good for people and also are good for the environment. And so what I'm going to be doing today is talking about four things. First, I'm just going to do a very brief introduction to the Nature Conservancy's Africa program and more specifically what we're doing in Tanzania. And then second, I'll show results from a vulnerability assessment that we've done that shows how climate has been changing historically and what climate is likely to look like in Western Tanzania in the next 50 to 100 years. I'll then share how this is likely to impact key ecosystems and people's livelihoods in the region. And then finally, I'll end up with sharing with you some of the climate adaptation strategies that we have developed with partners to try to deal with these climate changes that we're expecting into the future. So the Nature Conservancy's Africa program has three priority projects. They're located in northern Kenya, in western Tanzania, and in western Zambia. And we're also working with partners in Namibia and in coastal Mozambique. Our approach in Africa is to really concentrate in areas that are intact, in areas that have the ecosystem services still functioning, for example, in places where there's fresh water that's still available for drinking and for agriculture and for hydropower. And so basically we're working with people to protect these areas for future generations. And our premise is that if we can have Africa develop in a way that both harnesses and protects the natural resources, then its future is much more likely to be sustainable. And so specifically, we've chosen to focus on people who are living on the communal lands and waters that fall outside of the national park system. And we've chosen these areas for very specific reasons. First of all, they're often very biodiverse, so that makes sense. And also, they are clearly very important for people in terms of their livelihoods. We estimate that roughly 60% of the African continent is communally managed. And so basically, we're working in communal landscapes with nature to protect the natural systems that are there. So the Conservancy's work in Africa is based on three main guiding principles. The first is we work in partnership with government and other locally based conservation organizations. The second principle is that we create and implement conservation strategies that benefit and have value for both people and nature. And the third guiding principle is that we work to transfer skills and our knowledge and our information and our tools that we've developed both here in the United States and also all over the world to our partner organizations and our projects in Africa. So these would be things like our conservation planning expertise, our climate change adaptation work, our fire management expertise, and so on. And so these principles are really at the core of our work in Western Tanzania. And this is basically the area that I'll be referring to for the rest of my talk, just to kind of orient you. So this project has been occurring along the eastern edge of Lake Tanganyika, and it involves the ecosystem surrounding Gombe National Park, where James, the Jingle Institute, initiated their work about 60 years ago. And actually, Jingle Institute now covers this large expanse here called the Gombe Masisi Ugala region. And it also includes this area down further to the south, the greater Mahale ecosystem, which includes Mahale National Park, Katave National Park, and the Sitsu Ugala. And in fact, it's this southern region here that the Nature Conservancy is working in. And we have named this area the Tutungani Project. That means let's unite in Swahili. So that's the area where the Conservancy specifically has been focusing. And I think it actually is helpful to kind of back up for a minute and explain what drew us to Western Tanzania in the first place, just so you have some context. A few years ago, we did a scientific assessment of the entire continent of Africa to try to figure out which areas were the most biodiverse and which made the most sense to work in. And basically, as a result of that, what we found is that this area of Western Tanzania, specifically around Lake Tanganyika, was an exceptionally biodiverse area at the terrestrial and the freshwater interface. So it made a lot of sense for us to really target this area in terms of our program in the continent. And our Tutungani project is pretty unique in the Conservancy in that it both is seeking to both simultaneously conserve terrestrial and freshwater resources and to meet human health needs. And when I say human health needs, what I'm referring to is both primary health care as well as reproductive health services. And we're doing this in partnership with an organization called Pathfinder, who's spent decades working on health and reproductive issues around the world. So basically, this is really important in this area of the country for a number of reasons. First of all, this area has a lot of unmet health needs. People want increase and better access to health care, and they're asking for more reproductive services. So it's a need that's not being met. This area is extremely remote. In these villages that surround Mahale National Park, there are no roads. Very, very remote. If a woman goes into labor and has difficulty, she has a 20-hour boat ride to the nearest hospital, which is tough if you're having complications. So that's a problem. And then in addition, this area of Tanzania, the western portion of Tanzania, has the highest population growth rate in the country. It's 4.8%. So it's really, really high. And so as these village populations are growing, what you see is that people are expanding their settlements and their farms into areas of intact forests so they can continue to provide for their families. And this is creating a lot of ripple effects. You have the direct effects of deforestation directly, but then you're also having a lot of indirect effects. You're having increased sedimentation flowing down into the lake, and this is a problem because fish don't like dirty water. It's clouding up the areas where they breed along the coastal zones, and you basically are having decreased availability of water for drinking and for agriculture. So it's creating a lot of ripple effects as well as the direct effects of losing the trees. And so we believe that in order to successfully conserve this region's freshwater and terrestrial biodiversity, you have to both protect the waters and the forests as well as meet human health needs. And that's the focus of this project that we have at the Conservancy. So if you were to travel with me to western Tanzania, what you would see as you started to arrive were broad expanses of evergreen forests and miombo woodlands with a lot of rivers and streams and associated wetlands crisscrossing the landscape. And you would definitely not be able to miss the most notable landmark, which is Lake Tanganyika. It's the second largest lake in the world, and it holds 17% of the world's available fresh water. So it's an important place. And so, as I mentioned before in this talk, the people's health and the well-being of these people who live in the area is directly tied to the health of the natural systems that they rely on. And so most people who live in this area are either farmers or fishermen, and so they really rely on the forests and the woodlands, the lake and the rivers for their food, their water, and their shelter. They're just directly tied to the environment. However, like most places in the world, or many places in the world, these systems are really degraded by overuse. We have high deforestation rates, fishery stocks are declining. And in fact, with the increase in poverty and with the increase in population growth rate, these threats are just magnified. And so we basically feel that, in addition, of course, climate change is continuing to magnify these threats. And so basically the question that launched this specific study that I've been working on is, what is going to happen to these ecosystems and these people's livelihoods as they face yet another stressor, which is climate change? What's going to happen? And so some of you may have heard some of these examples. There have been a number of examples over the last couple of years of impacts of climate change all around East Africa. These have been in the scientific literature. They've been in popular news media. On Mount Kilimanjaro, we've seen a roughly 90% loss of ice cover, which has led to about 13,000 hectares of montane forest being lost. In East Africa, there's been a documentation of an increased frequency of drought over the last 20 years. In Lake Tanganyika, people have been reporting declining fish catches. And in Kenya, a number of researchers have reported a decline in bird populations in the high mountainous region. So there's been a lot of evidence that things are changing. At our first workshop in western Tanzania, we started by asking people all around the workshop, basically, have you seen any changes in where you either live or where you work that you think could potentially be attributed to climate change? And we heard a whole range of answers. It was a really interesting exercise. Many, many people commented on changes in temperature. They've been noticing that it's been getting hotter or warmer sooner than it has historically. A lot of people had comments about the rainfall, either that the rains weren't coming at the time where they had been, where they're getting a lot of rain in particular times of year. But then more interestingly, we had other things that people were noticing. So in particular, some of the large rivers, people were saying, you know, these rivers have run historically all year round, and now they're becoming seasonal. And some people said different plants in my village, such as the mango trees, they're actually flowering at different times of year. So people have been noticing all kinds of impacts or changes to their environment that they think potentially could be attributed to climate change. And so what we wanted to do was to actually look at whether actual data from the weather stations around the country show that there had been increases in temperature or precipitation over the last number of years. I mean, has climate really been changing, which is why people are observing these different things, or could be one reason. And so what we did is we used the Nature Conservancy's tool called Climate Wizard. It's a web-based tool that you can use to generate climate forecasts and look at historical trends. And we used this to look at data from climate stations around the country of Tanzania. And so basically what we found when we did this is that climate has, in fact, been increasing over the last 50 years in western Tanzania. It's been increasing at a rate of 0.1 degrees C per decade, and it's been increasing across all seasons. In contrast, there's been just a very slight increase in annual precipitation, but that increase is not statistically significant. And so then what we wanted to do is we wanted to know, well, what about the future? What's likely to happen in the next 50 and 100 years? And so we used this same Climate Wizard tool, and we basically, I'm going to get just a little technical here for a moment for any of you that do any climate science,
but not too technical for those that don't. So we looked at 16 general circulation models under three different emission scenarios. And we basically used data that had been downscaled to 50 square kilometers. And so the results that I'm going to show you are part of an ensemble analysis. And all that means is that it combines the results of all 16 models. And so you'll see the spread of the models when I show you some of the results. And so, let's see. Oh, one thing I wanted to mention is that one of the criticisms that you'll often see when you look at the literature on climate change in terms of forecasting is that a lot of people talk about what's going to happen with the temperature and what's going to happen with the rainfall, but they don't talk about the interaction between those two. And that's really, really important. So in addition to looking at temperature and precipitation, what we did is we generated an index for moisture surplus, which indicates times when you would expect flooding, as well as moisture stress, which indicates times when you're likely to see things become much more arid. Okay, so we've got all of those things. And so what we found when we did this is that all the models agree it's going to get hotter in Tanzania, okay, in the future. Basically, by 2050, temperatures are projected to increase 1 to 2 degrees Celsius, and by 2100, that increase is likely to be up to 4 degrees Celsius. So pretty serious increase. In contrast, there is actually no significant difference projected for annual precipitation. This means the amount of rain that falls within a 12-month period. However, when you start to look at monthly patterns, what you see is a real increase in the variability of rainstorms. So you have more water likely to fall in the wet season and less water likely to fall into the dry season. And so one thing I also want to mention, because some people have asked me this, especially the more technical people, these analyses did not include looking at sea surface temperatures in the Indian Ocean. And here's why that's important to know. The Indian Ocean, which is just adjacent to Tanzania, it's warming more rapidly than any other ocean in the world. And what happens when ocean temperatures rise is that more maritime or rain over the ocean falls, and that leaves less water to fall over the adjacent landmass. Okay, so all the results that I showed you in terms of precipitation are likely to be underestimates or very conservative in terms of what's going to happen with water availability. And it's just that the models aren't sophisticated enough yet to incorporate those sea surface temperatures to the ocean. But I just wanted to point that out. It's a nuance that some more technical people have asked me. So we've written some detailed climate change analyses, reports on all of this information that goes into much more detail if you're interested. For the purposes of today, I want you to just remember four things, okay, four facts. First of all, temperatures are going to continue to rise, and that rise is going to occur across all seasons. Secondly, we may not see changes in annual rainfall, but we will definitely see changes in the frequency, the intensity, and the predictability of rain, with likely wet seasons becoming wetter and dry seasons becoming drier. And then finally, despite increased rainfall, it's likely to become much more arid in Tanzania, especially western Tanzania, and that's because the higher temperatures create more evapotranspiration. So the next step was to figure out what these forecasts potentially mean for people who live in this area and for the ecosystems that they rely on for their survival and their livelihoods. So these are the evergreen forests right in Gombe National Park, actually. And as I mentioned, the forests and the woodlands in this area have been under a lot of pressure for many, many decades. And as temperatures in this region continue to increase, a number of us that got together and kind of discussed what we thought would happen have basically hypothesized that what we think is going to happen is more and more people are moving into these forest and woodland areas. And they're basically going to be doing this because they're looking for more land for agriculture. So there's going to be increased clearing of forests for agriculture and for habitat conversion. In addition, we're anticipating that higher temperatures and increased deforestation are really going to decrease water catchments. So it's going to leave less water available for people in terms of drinking and agriculture and other things. That's going to be an issue. And then finally, due to increased temperatures, we're expecting to see an increase in the presence and the prevalence of vector-borne or mosquito-borne diseases like malaria and dengue fever. And I can tell you right now, there were people in our workshop that basically said, you know, I grew up in this village, and we never had to deal with malaria, and now people are falling sick from malaria. It's already happening in western Tanzania. Freshwater systems are also going to be very heavily impacted by climate change. And as I mentioned at the beginning of this talk, the majority of people who live in this area are either fishermen or they're farmers. And in the farmers in the area, they rely on rain-fed agriculture to grow their crops. It's not irrigated systems. And so because of this, we think that probably some of the most profound and the severe impacts of climate change are going to be on agricultural and on food systems. And so specifically what we're anticipating is that as water temperatures increase and as seasonal flooding increases, yet as general water flows decrease, what we're likely to see is less productive soils. We're likely to see a loss of natural cues for when to plant and when to harvest your crops, and we're likely to see shorter growing seasons. And then finally, Lake Tanganyika. So 10 million people in this water basin rely on the lake for food, for protein, and also for fish, for income. And Lake Tanganyika has been warming since the early 1900s. And so its water temperatures are currently outside the natural range of variation. In addition, wind velocities across the lake have decreased by 30% since the 70s. And the reason this is important is the lake is naturally stratified into two different layers, and the wind helps to mix those layers. And so what's happened is with the higher water temperatures and the less wind that's coming across the lake, scientists have documented a 30% decline in primary productivity. That's a documented scientific decline in primary productivity. And in fact, over the last couple of years, there have been a number of scientific articles that have come out saying basically that they are saying that decrease in primary productivity is directly related to a decrease in fish production, which is then directly related to a decline in the fishery stock available for people for protein and for food. I mean, for food and for income. And so we're anticipating that as climate change continues to change the way we are forecasting that it will, that these effects will just become magnified. So what are we doing to ensure that our conservation efforts can be successful despite all these changes that we're anticipating? And this is where the creation of climate change adaptation strategies has become really important. And so once we had all this scientific information, we knew how historically climate had been changing, we knew what likely projections were for the future, and we had created hypotheses for what is likely to happen to people and to the systems in the area, what we did is we convened a key group of stakeholders. We convened people from the National Park Authority, local government officials and district officials. We convened staff from the Jane Goodall Institute and the Franklin Zoological Society, staff who've been working in these communities for decades. And we all began to put our heads together to try to develop climate adaptation strategies to deal with these impacts. And so I'm showing you this because I just love this pictorial. It's basically a product that the group produced during one of the workshops. And basically it is a conceptual ecological model. That's just a fancy name for putting down on a single piece of paper some hypotheses of how you believe climate change is going to play out across your landscape. And so this is for the greater Mahale ecosystem. And so what this group is hypothesizing is that due to increased temperature and more unpredictable rainfall, you're going to see a series of things happen across the landscape. You're going to see an increased incidence of fire. You're going to see animal movements increase as they search for more water and more food in different places. You're likely to see increased stratification of the lake, even more stratified than it is now. You're likely to see a decrease in the capacity of wetlands to provide. So basically, this pictorial and other ones like it served as the foundation for the creation of the climate change adaptation strategies that we all came up with, and also helped us to determine what policy initiatives needed to accompany these adaptation strategies to help move them forward. And so our group identified eight categories that they thought were important to to think about in terms of identifying climate impacts and having strategies. And so we now have climate adaptation strategies in each of these 8 categories. And so before I wrap up, for the purposes of giving you an example of some of these, I just chose 3 to kind of illustrate what some of these strategies are. And I want to point out that they occur at different scales. And I think this is really good. This is a good thing. Our strategies are at different scales, and so I think working all together, that's actually going to help us advance our objectives in the landscape. So our first strategy has to do with land use planning. And so as you can hopefully see from the slide, land use patterns are really changing across the landscape in Western Tanzania, and climate change is accelerating this pattern. And so as a result, one of our strategies is to improve village land use planning and implementation by incorporating climate change information into these plans. And this is really important because village land use planning is a way to empower communities to sustainably manage their own natural resources. So the Jane Goodall Institute and the Frankfurt Zoological Society have been working on village land use planning for years. Don't know how long, guess been doing it for a long time, right? Yeah, exactly. And basically, village land use plans are really important because that's the way villages get officially recognized by the Tanzanian government. So it's really important to have these plans. What's different now as a result of this climate change work is for the first time, these village land use planning processes, which are local participatory processes, they're now going to include this climate change information. And so villages can use this information to decide, for example, where they're going to put their forest protected areas and where they're going to put their agricultural zones. And so then hopefully they can have these, for example, forest protected areas in areas where they're going to be most resilient to climate impacts that they can then persist into the future the way they need them to. So the second strategy is around fisheries that I'll share today. I've mentioned a couple of times how important Lake Tanganyika is for fish stocks, for protein, for income, for people. And so basically what this strategy is that we're working with people in fisheries to basically help them more sustainably manage their fisheries in light of the climate impacts that they're seeing. There's illegal fishing going on, fishing in sensitive habitats. We have increased sedimentation in the lake from deforestation levels, which is destroying some of the breeding areas, and then magnified by those climate impacts with the decreased wind and the higher wind temperatures, higher water temperatures, just you have a serious problem with fisheries decline in this area. And so what we're doing with our partners is we're working under the umbrella of the 2003 Tanzanian Fisheries Act, which basically empowers communities to decide how to manage their own fisheries. And so, again, we're providing them with this climate change information so that they can then manage their fisheries in a way that will enable them to continue to have fisheries as part of their livelihoods into the future. And then finally, the last strategy I'll share with you has to do with policy. And so as a result of developing all of these climate change adaptation strategies together, our group recognized that our policy efforts had to expand beyond including just local and district and regional level government officials to really going up to the highest levels of national government. And in fact, as Kristen just said, I'm actually just back from our latest workshop in Kigoma, and it was really successful. And basically, we had people from national levels of government. We had people from the vice president's office. And at the end of the meeting, there was a commitment to work together to basically help to develop the national climate change framework for Tanzania. So really wonderful spread of working up and down at all those layers of government. And so in conclusion, we really have a good understanding of how climate has been and is likely to continue to change into the future. And we've developed a strong set of climate adaptation strategies for how to hopefully help both people and nature become more resilient and adapt to this changing future. And the Nature Conservancy has this innovative on-the-ground project, our Tuungani project, where we're working on population and health and environmental issues to advance our conservation outcomes. And so in case you're curious, our next steps are basically to look for funding to start advancing implementation of these strategies that we've developed with our partners. And so I just want to end by thanking again USAID and LifeWeb for funding this work, and to thank the Jane Goodall Institute and the Frankfurt Zoological Society, TANAPA, and all of the government officials of Tanzania for being collaborating partners. Thanks.
We have about 20 minutes for discussion.
What's the land tenure situation in the area? Individual property titles, village, community titles?
A lot of the land is owned by the central government, and once the villages have their village land use plans, then they have essential ownership over those lands as well. But central government owns a great deal of the land in this area.
And when you ask your questions, you could say your name and the
and there are also other experts in the room, such as Alice and others who would like to answer as well. Don't feel shy about speaking out.
Hi, I'm Mike from the Maine Society.
Hi.
I like the representation across the landscape that was drawn at the workshop, and I did draw my attention to even the wildlife conflict that could come about because you're going to see increased migration with both man and animal. And so I'm wondering, does some of the strategies include like how you farm and fencing techniques to mitigate conflict because you're expecting more conflict? Or
that's a great question. So the human-wildlife conflict issue definitely came up in our workshops. We had a lot of discussion around that. That was definitely something that was top of mind for people. We don't have a specific strategy that we came up with that will specifically deal with it. I think probably the better way to think about it, at least how I've interpreted where we are now from those discussions, is that the knowledge that there will be more people likely moving around and more animals likely moving around. We talked about congestion at water holes and things like that as villagers try to get water at these water holes, and then elephants are going to come in. Clearly there's potential chimpanzees looking for additional food resources, perhaps going into villages where they haven't traditionally been there. It definitely, we talked about this. I would say we didn't come up with a specific strategy like we need to fence this or that. It was just more as we talked about what we hypothesized was likely to happen as we crafted the strategies under those eight categories. That was just top of mind in terms of how to craft the individual strategies without coming up with a specific one on conflict per se, because that is likely to kind of occur across the landscape. That's the best I can say. It definitely came up, and you're absolutely right. I mean, I like that you picked that up because that is going to become, I'm not a fortune teller, but that is very likely to become an issue in the future if this all pans out the way we believe it will. And
Tim Resch, USAID Africa Bureau. When I asked the Eastern DRC question, on the other side of the lake, is this population of people with similar, if probably not more extreme, pressures, weaker institutions, weaker capacity, operating in French? And so I was kind of interested in how we increase awareness and motivate action on the other side of the lake, because if Tanzania does everything right, at least the lake may not change.
Right, okay, so I'm not sure I'm going to answer your question directly, Tim, but what I will tell you is that the Lake Tanganyika Authority is a group of countries that surround the lake. So Burundi, okay, so basically covers the lake, right? And so these folks from the Lake Tanganyika Authority have been participating in our workshop. And so there is a widespread recognition. So we don't have representatives from each country, but we have people from the LTA. And so they are actively working on Lake Tanganyika issues. Fisheries issues in particular are a big one. So the best I can say to you is we are trying to reach into surrounding areas that are not part of Tanzania through mechanisms like the Lake Tanganyika Authority, and hoping that they're helping to spread this message through their constituents and then take those messages home.
And to add to that, I mean, the piracy is an issue around Mahale for the fishermen there because they're generally poorer than the fishermen that come over from DRC. And I think, and Alice, correct me, it's only a couple miles across the lake. The lake is that big, to DRC. I mean, Mahale is the closest area to DRC. But as governance has improved, I mean, considering where it was a few years ago in DRC, it actually is a little bit better in eastern DRC. They've seen a decline in piracy, but that's an issue, especially before holidays in DRC. Pirates will come over who have guns, and at night, I mean, a lot of the fishing for the sardine species in the lake takes place at night. And so they'll come at night and steal, you know, all the materials from the poor Mahale fishermen, and then they leave them in their boats. They take their motors, and then they leave them in the boats out on the lake. But I think it's getting, they said, when I was there last August, they said it's gotten better because DRC is getting a little more stable. But you guys work in DRC.
True, we work in DRC, but then we're up more north. But I think WCS is working on the other side.
Right.
And they are you with them? Yeah. And so I know that they're working in the other side of, across the lake. We are farther north on the Kivu.
I'm looking at, he just started with them, I guess, like,
Three weeks ago. I'm not familiar with talk about it in any knowledge.
Okay, my name is Jim Rieger. I work in the Latin America region in the Nature Conservancy. Hey, so health. So you start off by saying that the projects, that you're looking at the link between environment and health. And I just wondered if, in the climate, the work you're doing, are there any messages, are there any strategies for health?
That's a great question. So, not yet.
Okay.
But there will be. That's my quick answer. Because basically, we started this project before we kind of rounded out our Tokungani project into a true PHE project. And so, clearly, there are going to be health complications from the climate vulnerability reports that I referenced, that I'm happy to share, talk about health issues specifically. Again, malaria, dengue, those are some serious ones, but also just increased potential asthma and other things that are going to be life-threatening but make your life much more complicated and difficult. So we know climate is going to impact health issues in a negative manner, most likely, based on what we think we're going to see. And so that's really one of the next steps is for us now to specifically craft adaptation strategies around health. But we're not there yet, just because that we were moving faster.
The biggest link is actually going to be agriculture through food security. So as agriculture is, people are just doing rain-fed agriculture. They don't have any, mostly no fertilizer inputs, no animal traction, no machinery. It's all just hand-done with rain-fed agriculture. So the agriculture is going to be severely impacted by climate change. That will severely impact food security. That's probably going to be the one of the closest linkages to the health issues of food security for children.
Okay. Bill Mellon, I work on international issues for the Nature Conservancy. Well, it's clear that climate change has the potential of doing a lot of damage in these ecosystems. But to date, in recent decades, most of the damage that's been done to date has been done by population growth in a traditional society that's highly reliant on natural resources. So could you expand a little bit on the fact that there's a family planning aspect to this, that through partners and, you know, what it is they're trying to do and what their prospects of success are? Because at 4% growth, you get five doubles in a century.
Yeah.
It's hard to see how anything will survive if that goes on.
Yeah. Okay, so I think I can answer your question. And Kristen is a PHE expert, just so you know. So I might pump this on you. But here's my take on it from the scientist side, the more ecological side. First of all, I'd like to just, you didn't actually ask this, but I do like to make sure that I'm really clear with people. Climate change is most often a magnifier of the threats that are already on the landscape, okay? And that is a really important point. It's not like we have this, and we have this, and we have this, and then we have climate change. It magnifies often all the other threats that are already present. And that's a really key point for most audiences to make sure that they really get. That's the first thing. The second thing is, our desire to bring, to meet health needs is really dictated by what we're hearing from the people who live in this area. Okay, they don't have the health services that they want and they need. They don't have the reproductive services that they want and need. They want to be able to space out their children the way that they want to have healthy children that continue to survive and make it past 5 years of age. And so our desire to incorporate healthcare and reproductive services into our project is certainly, of course, because of the environmental impact, but also because we're meeting the needs of the people that are there. And just from my own, this is completely my own perspective, not necessarily TNC mantra, but it's hard to do conservation when you're not meeting the basic needs of people. I mean, it's hard to get them interested in environmental issues when their families are starving or sick or dying. So basically, it's part of our greater holistic strategy that if we want to be successful in this area of the world, we have to meet basic needs as well as think about the environment. So that's the best answer that I can give you. That's right.
That was good, Elizabeth, and Alice can add more. But so 10% of children in these districts in Western Tanzania die before their fifth birthday, which is pretty high, among the highest in the world. Women are having more children than they want to have, so our goal is not to say, oh, you should only have, I think the average number of children is like 7.2. Okay. I mean, it's really high. It's almost as high as Niger, which is the highest in the world, which is where I used to work. I work in these countries where they have lots of children. But the goal is, instead of having a child every other year, that most women would prefer to have a child, for those of us in the room who have had children, would prefer to have them maybe every 2 or 3 years instead of, year after year after year. And so it's sort of allowing people to have the number of children they want to have when they want to have them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, other people have asked us, well, why isn't, education a component of your project? Because education, along with women's empowerment, is the highest, is the fastest means, usually, of reducing birth rates. We can only do so much. I think Pathfinder is working very closely with the Ministry of Health in Tanzania. We're working with the fisheries ministries and with the forestry ministries. I think when you bring together government ministries, you tend to get a multiplier effect of having other ministries also then say, oh, we will provide a teacher for this school that doesn't have a teacher right now so that they don't have 300 children in one school, things like that. So we're hopeful that there'll be multiplier effects. But right now, the health needs are so great, and they're basically not being met by the government of Tanzania right now in Western Tanzania. So by providing that initial input, we're hoping that we'll get quicker.
True. And I mean, it's also the same thing across the landscape. I think where Mahale is much more remote, but I think it's the same thing in terms of both the knowledge as well as the infrastructure. And so really coming up with a system where women are able to have the information on family planning or birth spacing is really important. I mean, that's lacking, and it's always brought up as a top priority when you go to the rural communities, that, water, and health.
Right.
I'm sorry, I saw your hand up next, and I'll take yours.
I'm Ruth Byers, an independent consultant based in the area of ABCG. And sort of following on to your comments that climate change is a magnifier of these other threats. I've never really heard a good answer about what we would do differently than we were doing before, because everything that I've heard so far really is that, we should have been doing all this stuff anyway because these were threats before. And so this is just a way of increasing the attention and making people aware of urgency of this, that we better take action now, or is there really something new for climate change adaptation that we wouldn't have done?
So there, I think there are different things that we're doing. I'll give you two examples. One would be with agriculture, how I mentioned that soils are going to become less productive, you're going to have different cues for when to plant, harvest, different growing season lengths. So one of the discussions that we had under agriculture was whether we might need to think about planting different types of crops that would be more suitable in the new climate conditions. So that would create a major cultural shift, but essentially it's possible that the crops that are currently being grown in a particular area may not be viable in that area in the future. So you need to think about growing different type of crops. That has to do with changing temperatures and changing rainfall, directly related to climate change. It does not have to do with population growth or deforestation, that type of thing. So to me, that is one example of how adaptation strategies are directly related to a changing climate and not just related to the threats that have already been across the landscape. A second example, which isn't quite in my mind as concrete as that, is, for example, for the village land use planning. When you're trying to figure out where to put your village forest reserves, now people are going to be thinking about the climate impacts, that diagram of what happens when you cut down your trees and what happens with sedimentation and how do you actually place your village forest reserves in areas that are likely to be most resilient to the changes that you're seeing. And some of that is driven by temperature and precip and increased evapotranspiration. And it's a whole new set of factors that they're thinking about when they think about where to put their agricultural zones, where they think about where to put their forest-protected areas, and things like that. That is a whole new level of thinking. It's a whole additional piece of information that will help them become smarter about being sustainable in the future. So I do think this radically has changed things. I mean, yes, maybe we were doing village land use planning, but the village land use planning and the way those villages are going to think about these areas in the future is going to be radically different because of this climate change information. I believe that is the case.
Another example is with the road that's going to – they're actually trying to build a road, so it's about a third or a quarter of the way finished down from Kagoma down on the eastern side of Mahale Mountains Park. When they build the road, ideally they should be taking into account the big flood events because they're going to have to build bigger bridges. I mean,
yeah.
These are huge, huge rivers. If the flood events are going to be greater, they need to take into account the increased flood events that are going to occur with the climate change.
Yeah.
What do they use now? Ferries?
Well,
to get to those remote areas?
There's a ferry over the Malagarassi. I don't think
there's a.
Are there ferries on the flat?
Pontoon.
I haven't been south of the park. So
I don't know about Mahale, but at least disaster planning would be another another thing that when we do disaster planning, because volcanoes still happen or earthquakes happen or something like that. But I think climate change, the probability of more frequent and more severe disaster events needs to factor into our disaster planning activities.
Absolutely, yeah. I know you had a question.
Jean Rushasha from the GF. I work in climate change adaptation team.
Right.
The question I had was, now that you're moving from strategy to actually implementation, except for funding, what are the challenges? What other challenges do you foresee in terms of technical implementation on the ground and also political?
Yes, that's a great question. We had, I think, Alice, you were at that workshop, so we talked about different barriers to, challenges. We had a great, sorry, this is side, but it's answering your question. We had a great session where we spent about 45 minutes talking about challenges and then like over an hour talking about potential solutions, which I loved. And in fact, if you're curious, like in more detail, I actually have that in the second workshop report. It's like a section of it. But going off of memory, I mean, some of the challenges, certainly funding, I mean, that's a huge one. I mean, you can't do anything if you can't fund it. But let's put that aside. Some of the challenges that people felt were really having high-level decision-makers and politicians in the country understand the climate change issues and be supportive in kind of incorporating this thinking of climate adaptation. That, I will say, I feel like that was more of a challenge before than it is now because we had 63 people at our last workshop that we just held that I'm just back from. And those were all high-level decision-makers, and it was really refreshing that they just embraced this information. You know, they presented what they've been working on. We presented what we've been working on. There were all kinds of breakout groups and discussions. As I mentioned, this commitment to work together into the future, that was seen at the second workshop as a big challenge, and we basically tried to solve that challenge or begin to solve that challenge by having this last workshop. And part of the outcome of this last workshop was we now have this greater network of people. We need to move together. We need to work together. We need to advance our work together. So that was one that's been identified. I'm sure we didn't solve it completely with that. That's the beginning, but I think there's a beginning of a solution there to something that was identified. Certainly education in the local communities was identified as a potential challenge, just making sure that people understand what climate change is what's coming, why they might want to think now proactively about, for example, different crops to plant, why they should incorporate climate change information into their village land use plans. But we had a strategy identified for education, actually, and the Jane Goodall Institute is taking the lead on that one for now. And so really getting information. We have brochures that we've printed in Swahili, which are going out to the communities to kind of help educate. People are going out to communities and educating people. So that was another one. So, again, these are challenges and barriers that were identified where we are starting to try. We've clearly identified, I think, a number of different solutions that now we're starting to implement, but we need to implement on a much wider scale. So it was the politics. It was the funding. It was the education and awareness. Those were the top ones. Those were the key ones that really came out in that workshop.
One other thing that I was also thinking of was, climate change is so uncertain. Even the data you showed, there's some amount under those uncertainties, decision making process becomes more difficult. Even with the strategy, actually, when you're doing implementation, it becomes more difficult because you have to choose which crop to plant and where.
Right.
Is there a solution? Is there some sort of solution for that that you come up with?
Here's how I personally have dealt with it. Again, this is like transcending just my work in Western Tanzania to also in the United States, so I'm going to kind of draw a little more broadly on that. So I guess as a scientist myself, when I work with a group of practitioners, I basically have found the most effective way to deal with that uncertainty in climate forecasting is to look at direction, magnitude, and trend, okay, rather than absolute numbers. So, for example, we ran 16 models under three different scenarios, okay? Every single one of those 16 under all three of those scenarios said it's going to get hotter. Like, there was not a one that said it was going to stay the same or get cooler. So the direction is hotter. And the magnitude is like varies, but it's going to get hotter. And I found when you get into a group, like if I sat you all down to do an exercise and I said, you all tell me what's going to happen if it's 1 degree hotter, and you all tell me what's going to happen to this forest system if it's 2 degrees hotter, you're probably going to come up with similar answers because we really don't understand really the difference between 1 and 2 degrees C. So where I'm going with this is, it's the direction, it's the degree of agreement between running, many, many scenarios. If they all agree, you can feel pretty certain it's going to get hotter. You may not know if it's 1 or 2.5, but you know you're going in that direction, and most of your strategies are going to deal with it getting hotter. And then the magnitude of that. So, again, magnitude, direction, and trend is personally how I've tried to work with people in interpreting climate information, with, of course, sharing that uncertainty, saying, we are not fortune tellers. We can't exactly predict what's going to happen in the future. That's why I call it projections rather than predictions. And so, but you can get a pretty good feel by if you run a number of models under a number of different scenarios and they're all saying the same direction, you get a pretty good feel. It's much more complicated when you have wide, half of them say it's going to rain more and half say it's going to rain less. For Western Tanzania, we just did not see that spread. It was fairly consistent. So for me in this area, I feel fairly confident myself that unless something radical changes, this is likely the changes we'll see in the next 50 to 100 years. And we've frankly set ourselves on this trajectory for the next 50 years, even if we stopped emitting today. Yeah, you bet.
This is a question from Jamil Mandima of AWF. Regrets he could not be here in person. He's curious about land tenure issues and how those will impact, and how climate change will impact on the binding agreements for investments that have happened thus far.
Can you answer that? I'm deferring to Alice of Jane Goodall Institute.
Well, I know during one of the sessions that we had last year, this was one of the discussions in terms of how policymakers can really take into consideration climate change when they're coming up with decisions on the general land. Because, most of the investments, the land for investments are being given in the general land.
General land is a government.
Yes, so it's government-owned land. And so when we're talking about the watersheds, when we're talking about, all these things that drain into Western Tanzania, some of them come from these particular areas. And so if the rainfall
you know, will be consistent, but then will, you know, be variable. So then what happens to farming, for example, in this area that's being given out? And how does that impact Lake Tanganyika? And so it was this whole situation where we really need to educate the policymakers as they're coming up with decisions on where to give this land. And so through ABCG funding, for example, we're doing actually two things. So we're looking at the land in terms of the general land area, and then looking at where would be the best places to farm, where would be the best places for the government to actually give out land farming, where would be the best places for conservation efforts to happen. So rather than telling the government, okay, stop everything, we actually have like an economic analysis of why it's not good to have the investment here. And then the second thing we're going to be doing for this area is coming up with a general management plan. So it's going through a whole session of looking at the resources that are there, identifying which ones are the high biodiversity areas, which ones, you know, could be maybe optic zones. So we're coming up with these two activities through funding from ABCG. But in terms of how that's impacting the investment, I think from the workshop that came out last week, hopefully I think that's a really good level in terms of zoning. And also through the workshop, we have talked about zoning because pastoralists also including this area. And so what can be done to really make sure that there's proper zoning that's put in place in the general land?
And just to add on to that, that funding is coming from USAID. That program and is linked in with several other organizations also looking at governance and land use, tenure, and planning issues. Also available on our website, abcg.org.
So it's one.
Okay. So one more question, and we'll wrap it up. Okay, that was perfect.
Thank you all for coming.